Good morning and welcome. My name is Elaine Holden, and it is my pleasure to welcome you to the opening Sunday of the 2018 Monadnock Summer Lyceum season with our guest speaker today, Larry Olmsted. We also thank today's sponsor, Arkilly Agway of Peterborough. Today's talk will be available on our website, monadnocklyceum.org, as a podcast within a few days. Our speaker today is Larry Olmsted. Larry is an award-winning journalist and author who has written several thousand articles for major newspapers and magazines worldwide for more than 20 years, as well as several books. Larry is a George F. Baker Scholar at Georgetown University, and he did his graduate work at Dartmouth College. He has also been in print as a columnist for two of America's national newspapers, Investor's Business Daily and USA Today. The Financial Times, New York Daily News, Boston Globe, Denver Post, and the South China Post are also privileged to have published his work. Not stopping at newspapers, Larry's prolific writing has also been featured in Playboy, Popular Science, Outside, Men's Health Incorporated, Worth, American Airlines American Way, Robb Report, and Golf Magazine. There is little wonder why Larry has been named one of the 10 most extreme United States journalists by the Society of Professional Journalists. His Forbes.com column was named one of the world's top 100 travel sites. In researching real food, fake food, Larry traveled to Japan, Alaska, Chile, Argentina, Scotland, Ireland, Italy, France, Spain, Portugal, South Africa, and all across the United States and Canada. This has resulted in a Publisher's Weekly starred review that stated, "Olmsted boldly walks readers through a course in food authenticity that covers olive oil, cheese, champagne, seafood, steak, coffee, and more. Readers will be inspired by his intensity and clarity and floored by how far some counterfeiters go to fool consumers and some historic food institutions go to protect their products and their names." Olmsted's research is impressive, and he lets no stone go unturned. He lets the terrifying facts speak for themselves, adding just a little humor. Olmsted's sharp language will hopefully put fires under counterfeiters everywhere. With the guiding hand of a good friend and prose that keeps the reader's eye moving, Olmsted insists that readers shop better and cook more. So don't take another bite or swallow another sip of anything other than our water until you listen to what Larry Olmsted has to say. So now please join me in extending a warm Monadnock Summer Lyceum welcome to our speaker, Larry Olmsted.
Thank you all very much for coming out, especially on such a hot day. I know I would not have blamed anyone who decided to stay home by the air conditioner. It's really a pleasure for me to be here. Over the last 2 years since my book came out, I've traveled around the country speaking about it to groups, but I live in Vermont, so coming here normally at this time, I've just gotten to the Manchester airport and I'm waiting for the bus in the economy shuttle lot, so this is a little bit easier trip, and I did not know until a few minutes ago about Peterborough's rich history of having the oldest tax-supported library in the country, so it's doubly good to be here. Thank you all for coming. I'd like to, since you all made the effort to come out here, I'd like to start with a little interactive exercise and involve you all. So I'm going to ask you if you would raise your hand and keep your hand raised if you have ever been to Italy. Okay, oh wow, it's a well-traveled town. Keep them raised. I want you to put your hand down if you enjoyed the food in Italy. Oh, there we go, there was going to be a holdout. So I find people come back in, from all over the world, but in particular from Italy, and they always say, God, the food was so good. Even the simplest pasta was so good, and the most basic tomato sauce was so good, and they can't kind of wrap their mind around why that is. And so I've looked into this and personally sampled more than a few plates of pasta over in Italy. And the most basic tomato sauce is pretty basic. It has just a handful of ingredients, usually tomatoes, extra virgin olive oil, basil, and some Parmesan Reggiano cheese. And it's really that simple, but it's not that simple, which is why it tastes that much better. The traditional tomato of choice for making sauce in Italy is the San Marzano tomato, which is a plum or pear tomato that grows in the volcanic rich soil left over from the eruption of Mount Vesuvius. And they use very high quality extra virgin olive oil, and they have great basil that grows on the Ligurian coast, and they use Parmigiano Reggiano, the king of cheeses. A lot of times here in the United States, you might go to an Italian restaurant and have a very similar dish, except the basil is the only thing in it that's real. Not the tomatoes, not the cheese, not the oil. That's sort of the bad news. The good news is that all of those products are available in this country in their original form, and you can, if you know what to look for, shop, make that same wonderful tomato sauce you had in Italy. Sometimes the products are a little bit more expensive, but they're a lot cheaper than the ticket, so you don't have to go. The advantages of having given a lot of these talks is I've been asked a lot of questions, and I will spare you having to ask all the same questions and jump to the number one question that I'm asked, which is, what do you mean by fake food? That's the first thing I always get. And being as we're here in New England, I like to use the example of the North Atlantic lobster. And you all know he's got two claws, kind of looks like that. Commonly called the Maine lobster because they're really good marketing, but you know, New Hampshire, Connecticut, Rhode Island, even our neighbors to the north in Canada, all have the same lobster, unique to this this part of the world. And the North Atlantic lobster is a wild animal that is not farmed in any way. It's not raised with steroids or antibiotics or growth hormones. It's out there in the ocean. And when you get a Maine lobster or a North Atlantic lobster whole, you cannot be fooled. There's nothing else they can put on your plate that looks like a lobster. However, once you order lobster salad, or lobster bisque in particular, lobster roll, the more cut up, processed, things added to it, suddenly it doesn't look like that happy-go-lucky lobster anymore. And 2020 did a study where they went to restaurants around the country and they ordered things like lobster bisque and lobster salad. And national chains, including Red Lobster, as well as local restaurants all around the country, and a third of the dishes contained no lobster. So, this guy, hole on your plate, is real food. Lobster bisque that has no lobster is fake food. That's the sort of extreme. And then there's a big gray area in the middle. Because when you do something like sell red snapper for $20 a pound, but give the consumer tilapia that costs $2 a pound instead, or you sell extra virgin olive oil that's been cut with soy or peanut oil, that's illegal. A lot of the topics in my book are not necessarily that clear. There are things like Parmesan cheese, which I talk about. In this country, you can go to the supermarket and buy a tube of 100% grated Parmesan cheese that is neither a Parmesan cheese nor 100% cheese of any kind, but that's legal. I still consider it fake because it's not what they're purporting to be selling you. It's not what you intend to be buying. So you have these illegal fakes, these legal fakes, and then in the middle there's a big gray area, which is where I use the example of Kobe beef. Right? Kobe beef is a very famous Japanese prized beef that has no legal definition in the United States. So it is completely legal for restaurants and butcher shops to sell you Kobe beef and give you virtually anything. And they do, a lot, most of the time. And but if the restaurant is marketing this as this famous Japanese beef, then they sort of ventured into the fraud category. So a lot of these foods, it depends how they're presented to the consumer, whether or not they would qualify as fake food. And I always just go back to, what do you think you're buying? What are they trying to sell you? And if it's not that, then I have a problem with it. And this is not a new problem in any way. My book came out in 2016. 2016 was the 500th anniversary of the Reinheitsgebot. I can't speak German, so I'm butchering that. But it is better known as the German beer purity law, or the Bavarian beer purity law. And it's widely regarded as the first major consumer protection law in history. 500 years ago, the Germans, or the Bavarians at the time, defined beer, what could and could not go into something labeled and sold as beer. And the idea, as with many of these laws since, is not that they couldn't ferment and sell other beverages. It was that, as a consumer, when you bought beer, you had a reasonable expectation of exactly what you were getting and what you were buying. And that is, as I said, generally considered the first big consumer protection. But I found a law enacted in the city of London almost 200 years earlier, in 1379, that specifically addressed pasties, which are British meat pies, and forbid the selling of venison meat pies containing beef. And that speaks to this big issue, which is venison is more expensive than beef, and that is why they have that problem. It's never the other way around. Seafood is something I'm going to be talking about, a lot of problems with seafood. And when you go into that restaurant and you order the $20 red snapper and you get the $2 tilapia, the restaurant owner always says when they're caught that it was a mistake. Botch was mislabeled. If that was the case, sometime you would order tilapia and get red snapper. I've never come across an incident in all the research I did for this book of someone getting something more expensive than they paid for. So it's sort of a one-way street. But the good news is that these kind of things have led to all consumer protection. So I like to think when you have a lemon law in your car or privacy laws or any of this, it all stems from these early consumer protection laws for food. So there's some good news. And that's a point I want to make early on, because some of the stuff in my book is a little scary for people who like food, but that is not the intention. I'm a very optimistic person, and I look at it as a glass half full rather than a glass half empty. And when I was researching and writing this book, I got very angry at a lot of the things companies and restaurants and producers were doing to deceive the public. And for a long time, probably close to a year, my working title was Fake Food, Real Food, because I was being driven crazy by all this fake food. But then I had this sort of aha moment where I realized that the only reason why there are all these fake foods is because the real things are so good. You know, I say, if you go to Chinatown in New York and there's counterfeiters out on the street selling handbags, they're going to be selling fake Louis Vuitton and fake Gucci. And or as I say in the book, you can buy a fake Rolex, but you can't buy a fake Timex. And there's a reason for that. And that's what these foods are. And when it dawned on me, and when I met some of the producers making the real things and how good they are, I switched the title to Real Food, Fake Food, because the real food is what's important, and it's worth seeking out. It's delicious. It's almost always better for you. And I want to celebrate the idea of the real food and keep you from avoiding the fake food, rather than having what some people after these talks come up and say, I can't eat anything anymore. That's not the goal for today. And the other big question that I get a lot is, how did you come to write this book? Or why did you write this book? And I, as Elaine mentioned, I've been writing on travel and food topics for 20 plus years. And so I had already been to a lot of places and experienced a lot of good foods. And I was in Parma in Italy, which I've been to several times. I was there again a week and a half ago. And The cover of my book has a picture of a wedge of Parmigiano Reggiano, which in the dairy industry is known as the king of cheeses, probably the most respected cheese in the world. And it is produced in Parma, which is why it's called Parmigiano. But also you have Prosciutto di Parma, another famous product of Parma. Barilla, the world's largest pasta maker, is based in Parma. Parma borders Modena, which is where all the good balsamic vinegar is made. It is the food production epicenter of Italy. Not a lot of Americans go there on vacation, which is a little bit of a shame, but if you're Italian and you're asked where does the best food in Italy come from, you always say my town, and then if you're asked what's the second best, you say Parma. So I went to Parma and I was visiting a dairy where and learning how the Parmigiano Reggiano cheese is made. And the cheesemaker said, you know, was explaining all the quality controls and the drug-free cows and the wonders of the fresh milk, and said, no, it's not like your country. I said, what do you mean? He said, oh, in your country, you can sell anything called Parmesan cheese. It doesn't even have to be from cows, doesn't have to be aged, doesn't have to be drug-free, any of these things. And I thought, oh, that kind of sucks. So I filed that away. It was, you know, an interesting moment, but it wasn't quite enough of an epiphany for me to write a book. And then not long after that, I was in Japan. I've had the good fortune to visit Japan a few times. It's an incredible country, but an incredible food country in particular. And I tried Kobe beef, which is sort of the Rolls Royce of meat. Very expensive, very rare, very scarce, and most of all, very distinctive. Kobe beef looks very different from what our steak looks like, and it tastes very different. In short, once you've had it or seen it, it's very hard to be fooled. But I came back to the U.S., and I was in a number of fancy steakhouses that had Kobe beef on the menu, and I tried it, and it never looked or tasted anything like it did in Japan. And beef is a food that actually travels very well, as most of the meat we eat is frozen anyway. It shouldn't lose anything in translation. So I looked into it, and it took me about 5 minutes searching on Google to discover that the importation of Japanese beef was banned in the United States, categorically. This was several years ago. It is no longer banned, but it has been banned for most of the 21st century. And this was in all forms, whole cuts, bone, processed, not just Kobe beef, but all beef from Japan. Not allowed in the United States at all for restaurant, personal use. Yet hundreds of restaurants in the country purporting to sell Kobe beef on their menu, every single one of them lying. So that caught my interest, and I write this column for Forbes, and a lot of my readers have expense accounts and work in finance, and so I wrote this story called The Great Kobe Beef Scam, basically about how you're getting ripped off at these steakhouses. And of the thousands of articles that I have published, no other one has gotten the kind of response that this article got. Thousands of comments, mostly angry, really feeling of victimization. To date, somewhere like 1.3 million people have read this article online, which is an enormous amount in that business. But it's Kobe beef. It's not something that you go to the supermarket to buy for your kids or you're going to find on the school menu. It's a 0.1% of food that doesn't affect most of us in any way at any time. So my thought was, if this many people are this upset about a food that they don't even eat, what if it was bigger than that? And I thought about my experience in Parma, and I started to research it, and unfortunately, I discovered that it is a big problem, and that led me to write this book. And which begs the question, how big is this problem? And I like to start by thinking about coffee. I just had a cup in the back there, coffee. Coffee is not just the most valuable agricultural product in the world. It is the second most valuable commodity on Earth after oil. Coffee is more money than gold or steel or anything else that we take from the planet. Coffee is big business. Coffee also has a long, rich tradition of food fraud. But that's just one category of food. The global food fraud and adulteration business is generally estimated at very close to $50 billion, which is a big enough business to attract organized crime, unscrupulous marketers, anyone looking to sort of pad their pockets. The grocery manufacturers of America estimate that about 10% of all the products sold in retail and grocery stores are some way adulterated, inauthentic, or fake. That's 1 out of 10 items. So unless you're leaving through that 8-item or less express checkout, it's probably something in your cart. So this is something that affects normal people on a daily basis, not just Kobe beef eaters. But the prevalence of the fraud varies a lot by the type of food, obviously, and also where you're getting the food. Another question I am very frequently asked is, what was the most surprising thing you discovered writing this book? And people always expect me to say that, like, oh, all sushi is bad, which it is, but that didn't surprise me. It's restaurants. It never really occurred to me before I started writing this that what little we have in the way of labeling laws in this country, and they're pretty inferior, the FDA, the USDA rules, apply only to retail food. They don't apply to restaurants. So, you know, you go down to the Price Chopper or Hannaford or whatever, and they label USDA Choice Steak Prime, they're probably going to get fined and caught, and they're probably not going to do it because it can open up a big can of worms for a big supermarket chain. Restaurant does it. In most states, there's no penalty for that. It is defined at the state law. So why wouldn't a restaurant say, yeah, it's 28-day dry-aged, grass-fed, hormone-free, local farmer, you know, wild-caught Alaskan salmon beef, whatever it is. The more nice words are in front of it, I've become increasingly suspicious of. So that's the big, there's a big difference whether you're eating out or eating in, but there's problems with both. And again, it really varies by the type of food. So personally, I've been buying and eating a lot of bison or buffalo. It's very cleanly produced, reliable food. And I have yet to find evidence of an incident of somebody passing off another meat as buffalo. I'm sure it's been done, but it's not something I worry about when I go to the store. So that's sort of the good end of the scale. Then there are things like dried spices that you might not think of, pretty innocuous, things like oregano and basil, and the dried version, which when tested, about a third of them are cut with other plant matter, such as lawn clippings. But that's still, it's a third, so you got a better than even chance when you go and buy dried oregano that you're actually going to get dried oregano. But it kind of goes downhill from there. You've got extra virgin olive oil, which is probably the product that has received the most media attention over the last 30 years. 60 Minutes did a big special. Basically, every major news outlet has reported on the extra virgin olive oil troubles. It has gotten better in the last few years, so now you're looking at about a 50-50 coin flip when you go to the supermarket over whether or not that olive oil is real. It used to be more like you had a 30% chance, so it's trending. Then we move into seafood, which is the single most problematic category I covered in my book. And it's not because people in the seafood industry are evil and people in the poultry industry are friendly. It's because we, for the most part, don't know what seafood looks like. There's about 500 commercially available species of seafood widely available in the United States versus basically one kind of chicken. So when you go to the supermarket, you might be confronted with, do I want to buy that natural, quote, big air quotes for natural, but natural chicken, organic chicken, the Amish chicken, the free-range chicken, but they're all chickens. And typically, unless you're going to a local farm that has an heirloom breed, they're all the same species of chicken. And you know what a chicken looks like. This is not the case for seafood. Most of us do not know what any of the fish we eat regularly actually looks like because we don't buy it as fish. We buy it as fillets or steaks or otherwise cut up. And most, with the exception of salmon and steelhead trout and a couple of fish, most of the fish we eat are white fish. And I talked to a number of fishmongers and professionals in the seafood industry who said that even with 20 or 30 years of experience, once you fillet and cut up two white fish and put them on a cutting board next to each other, they can't tell them apart. They can't tell the red snapper from the tilapia. So, you know, how are you going to? And so the former chairman of the FDA, told me, if you have any two foods that look the same and one is more expensive, you're going to have fraud. It doesn't matter what food it is. It's that simple. The opportunity is too big for people to make money. And seafood just really lends itself to that. So your pricier fish, like your red snapper, grouper, consistently, and there have been hundreds of studies, local, they do it in Boston, in New York, or nationwide, these fish are substituted 80 to 90-plus percent of the time. So one reporter in L.A. said, you know, you can go to L.A. and eat out at a nice restaurant every night for a week, order red snapper every night, and you will probably leave never having had red snapper. Red snapper is the single worst fish. It's in terms of fraud, it's delicious fish. Most studies, 92 to 94% of the time you buy or order red snapper, you do not get it. So that's kind of the high end of the fraud problem, with the one glaring exception of sushi. Probably the biggest negative comment I've gotten about my book since it's come out is, you ruined sushi for me, which I hear a lot. The bad news is it ruined sushi for me as well, and I love sushi. I'll still eat it in Japan. About 100% of sushi restaurants in America are serving you fake food. There are a handful of exceptions in New York and Vegas, and very expensive. If you want to pay $200, $300 for dinner, you can get good sushi. If you don't, you're going to have some real problems. The sushi restaurant sector is the single worst offender that I came across. And in almost all studies, and again, nationwide, they've been done in New York, they've been done by every major news outlet, usually close to 100% of the restaurants fail. When they did it in New York, they had one restaurant that did it. And my favorite, students at UCLA did a four-year study in the Los Angeles area, dozens of restaurants. They went and ordered it, and to make sure that it wasn't a fluke, they did this every year for 4 years, the same restaurants. So visiting all these restaurants over a four-year period, each one four times, 50% of all the sushi samples that they tested were not what they claimed to be. 100% of those claiming to be red snapper or halibut were not what they... So in 4 years, in the largest city in the country, on the water, they could not find one restaurant that could sell them red snapper or halibut, which is, you know, kind of a glaring problem. So, and then a lot of these issues are what the FDA terms economic cheats, meaning you pay for something and you don't get it, and you've been ripped off. The FDA does not deem economic cheats a very important part of its limited resources and budget cuts. They're only concerned about health issues, and they don't consider food fraud a real health issue. So I'm always asked, is this dangerous? And the answer is yes. But not always, but in a lot of ways. So the biggest problem with food fraud in terms of health is omission. You buy something because you think it's good for you. And I like to use the example of extra virgin olive oil, because despite the fact that a lot of players in the olive oil industry were not happy about my book, I love extra virgin olive oil. I use way more of it than the average American. I'm very careful about how I buy it. I put it on steak, which is a Tuscan thing to do, but not very popular in this country. And it is sort of a miracle food. It's one of the only food products you can buy that has been demonstrated to be heart healthy in the same way as drugs are. It went through the same kind of testing by the FDA to bear that claim, but it has also been shown in lots of tests to do things like lower cholesterol, it's high in antioxidants, it's been shown to be an anti-aging, have anti-aging properties, anti-carcinogenic properties, even anti-Alzheimer's properties, and it seems like every time they study olive oil, they find something new and amazing that it does. So there's a lot of good reasons to consume it. It also tastes really good when it's real olive oil. However, when they do consumer perception studies, the two reasons people say they buy olive oil are for the taste and the health attributes. When you buy fake olive oil, you get neither of those. So that's where a lot of the sort of health concern comes in with these fake foods, is you don't get what you think you're getting. It's like buying vitamins and finding that they're sugar pills. But then there are some more real problems. Congress actually recently ordered the FDA to step up its enforcement of olive oil, and they did not do this for the consumer protection for money. They did this because of growing allergen concerns that the products that oil can be cut with, mainly corn oil, soy oil, or peanut oil, are all things that a lot of people are allergic to, and things that even if you were careful, you could not avoid by reading the ingredients, because the ingredients say 100% olive oil. There's not supposed to be soy or peanuts or corn in olive oil. So, you know, that's one example. The other one, I'm gonna pick on sushi again here. There's a fish out there called escalar. Most people aren't particularly familiar with escalar, even though a whole lot of it is imported and sold in this country. Escalar is a fish that contains a unique fatty wax ester that is known to put it politely, cause digestive distress. And its nickname in the seafood industry is the Ex-lax fish. So that'll give you an idea of escalar. Escalar is one of the most common substitutes for tuna at sushi restaurants in this country. So you go, you order tuna, you pay for tuna, you get escalar. And if you eat sushi regularly, sooner or later, you have that day when you wake up, and people say, must have had bad tuna. I've heard that from many readers. But no, the problem is you never had tuna at all. If you had tuna, you wouldn't be sick. You're sick of escalar. And ironically, you know, we imported the tradition and passion for eating sushi from Japan, and Japan's very health conscious, so escalar is banned in Japan. It's also banned in Italy. It also used to be banned in the United States, but no longer. And this is just one example of a number of suspect fish that are imported into this country in large quantities simply to be substituted for other fish. If you look at the 10 most commercially traded fish in the United States, they'll include things like panga that most people never heard of. I've never heard anyone say, I'm going down to the supermarket to get a pound of panga. Yet, panga sells more than most fish you've heard of because it's imported from farms in Southeast Asia, many of which have been demonstrated to use all kinds of illegal drugs and fertilizers and pesticides in farming these fish just to be passed off as more expensive fish. So there is definitely a health concern to all of this. And when I personally buy beef now, and I love meat, so I haven't shied away from that, I buy grass-fed, drug-free beef. I know what it wasn't given, what it ate. You still have to, you know, have a source that you believe. But if I buy that and then it's not what I thought it was, I'm doubly upset because now I paid a premium. I went out of my way. I'm trying to eat something that is not poisonous, and I'm getting ripped off. So it kind of underscores to me the importance of shopping and paying attention to these things. And so I'm going to give you some good news. Like I said with the tomato sauce to begin with, right? The San Marzano tomatoes are imported. You can go to a supermarket and buy a can of Italian San Marzano tomatoes. You can buy real olive oil. You can buy real Parmesan Reggiano cheese. You can make that sauce. You just have to know what you're looking for. And that's why I broke my book into chapters on specific topics like seafood, olive oil. And at the end of each chapter, I give very detailed lists of label terms, things to look for, questions to ask in restaurants, and it's way too much of those to go through all of them now, but I'm just going to give you some sum up here by giving you some very broad stroke good tips that will help you shop better and eat better. One of them would be, when possible, buy products produced in the European Union. They have stricter labeling laws. They have a longer history of ingredient-obsessed food culture. And when you go and you buy those San Marzano tomatoes or particular kinds of olive oil or Parmesan Reggiano cheese, it's going to have a PDO symbol, which is Protected Denomination of Origin, indicating not just that it was made in Europe, but that it was made in a specific place under specific practices. Europe also has their own version of USDA organic called bio, and you'll see that logo on food, and it's a little stricter than our organic. So that's one thing. Then there's organics. Organics, there's definitely some problems with organics, but as food labels in this country go, it's a good one. And in sweeping generalizations, if you're in doubt and you buy the organic, you're at least going to, in theory, alleviate a lot of the concerns like the use of antibiotics, pesticides, things like that. Buy foods you recognize. It's like when I talk about the difference between chicken and fish. A few years ago, there was a lot of stories in the news about this big horse meat scandal in Europe. You probably remember it was all over the news. And it wasn't that people in Britain were going into restaurants and ordering a T-bone steak and getting horse. They were buying frozen beef lasagna and getting horse. And if you think about that, you know, if you took a frozen lasagna out and cut it in half and looked at it, it's gray frozen ground meat. It could be goat, it could be camel, you know, whatever's selling cheapest that day, horse. You have no way of knowing that. So buy things that are recognizable. It sounds pretty simple, but go back to the seafood for a second. Right? You go in and you say, give me a pound of red snapper fillets. You've just opened a can of worms. You go into the seafood store and you say, do you have a red snapper? They produce a red snapper. You have to go on Google and see what a red snapper looks like, but once you've seen it, it's very easy to recognize. Then you say, okay, clean that fish, cut it up for me. You have now, you don't have to have any special knife skills. You don't have to learn the anatomy of fish. You've just circumvented a big problem, and that's something you can do more often than you think with a lot of seafood, which sort of the final sweeping tip is buy things in their whole form whenever possible. And when these days we say whole foods, we usually either mean the supermarket chain or things like whole wheat. But when I say whole foods, I mean like an orange as opposed to orange juice, or a fish as opposed to a piece of a fish, or a lobster as opposed to lobster bisque. And when you do that, it's amazing. Even coffee. You go buy coffee beans, grind them yourselves, you might get that economic cheat. You might be paying a small fortune for Jamaican Blue Mountain beans, and they might not be Jamaican Blue Mountain beans, but they're coffee for sure. Nothing else looks like a coffee bean. So if it tastes good to you and you buy it as beans, you're getting coffee. You buy ground coffee, you're buying into hundreds of years of rich tradition of adulteration with all kinds of unpleasant things. So buy whole, shop wiser, eat better, and thanks for coming.